Warm Tulare County, welcome for our warm-up speaker, Jolene.
Hello, everybody. I'm Jolene, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm happy to be here tonight, warm-up speaker for Joyce, keeping me humble. And also always grateful to be able to celebrate sobriety, the gift that keeps on giving. I have to say that I've been fortunate by the grace of higher power in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I haven't had to take a drink since April 29th of 1974. And so if you're having up fingers and toes, you'll understand that for me to put my story in 10 minutes is like making tomato paste. You have to take like 10 bushels of tomatoes and get them all down so they fit in a 3-ounce can. So it's really been a challenge for me to think, okay, what is the most important thing for me to share tonight? I know we talk about how it was and what happened and what it's like now. So the shorthand version is I was born into an alcoholic and dysfunctional family with a lot of violence and all the kind of things that go with that. So before I ever picked up a drink, I already had the twisted thinking, and I was already living in fear, driven by a thousand forms of fear that they talk about in our big book. And I was always looking for some way to deal with that fear. I didn't know what it was as a kid, of course, but I did know that somehow that there was something terribly wrong, but there was nothing I could do about it. And I felt, like I said, I was always frightened and insecure. So when I got to the place where I could experiment with alcohol, it became my medicine. And I got to do that fairly early because there was always plenty of alcohol around in my family and the get-togethers and everything. But I wasn't exactly a heavy drinker at that time. I didn't do that until I got to be around 16, 17, something like that, where I had more access to. And actually, alcohol saved my life. It was my medicine. I have pictures of me as a little child, and you can see on my face how depressed I was. And I did struggle with depression off and on most of my life. So fast forward, by the time I was in high school, I was blessed with a very high tolerance. So I got to drink a lot, and I could be the designated driver, and I could party on and on. And then I went on to college and became more of an expert. And then by that time I was already having some blackouts. I didn't know what they were, of course, and I was getting more and more squirrely, and life was more difficult to manage. And so I did what any smart female alcoholic would do, is I married my drinking buddy. Not because I loved him, because I wasn't really capable of doing that, but I liked his family, and we were drinking buddies, and they liked me, and they thought it was kind of cute when I threw up on their front porch, things like that, you know. And he liked me because he was very withdrawn, and we would go to these fraternity parties, and I was the song leader and a party girl and all that. So we were a good team. Then we had kids, and my first child was born drug addicted and with alcohol and prescription drugs, because the family doctor felt like I shouldn't gain any weight, so he gave me amphetamines. So I was drinking, smoking, and taking amphetamines. So that poor child was born with a disease, and she was having seizures. And she went on to have a career as a drug addict, and no big surprise. And then later, in fact, by the time she was 23, she ended up dying from the addiction. She had quit using drugs, but she had contracted AIDS. So she ended up dying of AIDS when she was 23. That didn't happen until I was in recovery, thank goodness. Fortunately, I didn't have to drink through that. You know... Anyway, the marriage didn't last, of course. I had no desire to quit drinking, even though I had been in two psych wards and in the psychiatrist's office for several years, and had doctors and professionals tell me I'm not really an alcoholic, but I probably would be good if I didn't drink. So I would have pharmaceutically induced sobriety for periods of time, but I would always revert back to drinking. My drinking buddy husband didn't like me sober very much, so anyway, it's not his fault. It was the disease that we were both in, and unfortunately, we recreated the family of origin stuff, and it was, you know, abuse of each other and abuse of our children. And as I was progressing, it got more out of hand, and so I had decided to call his employer and talk to the employee assistance counselor and find out what I could do to get his drinking under control. And because I was really worried, because I knew I wasn't able to really fend for myself and my kids. So, and I was afraid he was going to lose his job. So my takeaway was, from over an hour talking to this counselor on the phone, is that I should go to AA to learn how to get my husband sober. So I came to you with no desire to stop drinking whatsoever. I always kind of laugh now when I hear it read, you know, the only desire, only requirement for membership is the desire to stop drinking. I didn't have that. My desire was to make my life manageable, which translated into controlling my husband's drinking. That didn't happen. I got into the program of AA boot camp in just outside Detroit, and had the good fortune to be going to meetings with people that went to meetings with Bob and Bill. So it was really old school. And one of the big things they kept convinced me is that if I would stop drinking, my life would become manageable. Just what I wanted to hear. So I said, fine, I'll quit drinking. And I did. Well, being crazy and not drinking and being an alcoholic, that is the recipe for a perfect storm. Mm-hmm. I did go to meetings for about 4 months, drinking and taking pills and detoxing and hallucinating and all those things. And just to back up a moment, my drinking career wasn't too exciting, except I did end up in the spring of 73. I ended up in the emergency where actually they took my corpse to the hospital, and I was revived into a coma and kept there for a month. And they thought I would be brain dead of sorts or crippled and had to be in a custodial care for the rest of my life, but I escaped. And I found you guys. So anyway, my recovery has been much more exciting than my drinking career. It wasn't that terribly long, and I was a suburban housewife married to an up-and-rising executive, you know, and I arrived here with a Girl Scout uniform under my clothes. I had no vision of me being an alcoholic, and I found myself in a smoky basement with a bunch of drunks, and it was really humiliating. And at that point, I hated my life. I just hated my life. I would have done anything to die, and I felt like I'd been condemned to live. And I didn't know any way out. And people would say, well, if you drink, you're going to die. And I'd say, is that a promise? You know, nobody could promise me that was true. But then someone would come along and try to take themselves out, putting a gun in their mouth and whatever. And I look at them and I think, oh my goodness, if I drink, that's probably what I would do. And then I'd end up all disfigured and ugly, so I didn't want to be that way. So long story short, I stayed dry for a little over a year, crazy as a bed bug. And I feel to this day, I apologize always to the people in AA who put up with me. I was terrible. I was yelling. I was banging on tables. I did everything except comply. But I didn't drink. And I ended up having a nervous breakdown. And that's when I ended up in therapy for a couple years in an outpatient program. My sobriety, I don't know when I got sober, really. I stopped drinking in April of 74, but my thinking was so twisted. It was, you know, and I was so delusional. I didn't even start coming to for a few years. And I had a lot of challenges, and I was a month sober when my husband left. So I really was crazy then. And what I have come to realize is that, and I've had a lot of challenges with the normal things that alcoholics do, you know, with jobs and relationships, and challenges with my daughter dying and ending up raising my grandson and things like that. And what I've come to realize is, you know, we read that alcoholism is cunning, baffling, and powerful, and it is. But I know that it saved my life. Alcohol saved my life, and alcoholism saved my life. Because if I wasn't an alcoholic, I wouldn't have got to AA. And if I hadn't got to AA, I wouldn't be alive today and here to celebrate life. And now I've come to think in terms of recovery as cunning, baffling, and much more powerful than alcoholism. And my life is a testimony to that. I've gone from being robbed of my basic humanity and my capacity to love and to care about being alive to a person that is very much alive, very much human, warts and all, not perfect for sure, and I have the capacity to love others and to be loved, which was never available to me before. So, like I said, alcoholism is cunning, baffling, and powerful, but recovery is much more powerful. So, if you haven't experienced any of the promises yet, I encourage you to just hang on, even if it's just to hang on to your butt, until something happens. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense, which is the good news, but it does work, and I encourage you all to keep coming back, as well I will too. Now, one of the other gifts that the program has given me, oh, and I forgot to set, I set my timer and I forgot to start it, sorry. I promised Joyce I'd be on time and I'd only talk 10 minutes. She's a tough taskmaster. There's really nothing I need in life right now. I've really found a level of contentment. That doesn't mean I don't have emotions, because I do. I have a family member whose drinking bothers me right now. But at the same time, I can have compassion for them, and I have a desire not to be part of the problem and to be have myself in a place where if I can be of service to that person, that I'll be able to. And that's the gift that keeps on giving for me, is now I've gone from a totally self-centered, self-absorbed, foolish young woman who couldn't find her butt with both hands to a person who celebrates when I get an opportunity to be of service to others in the program and out of the program. People are attracted to me for my recovery, and they don't even know what it's about. So, like I said, I've got just about everything I need, a lot of what I want. If I was going to put anything on my Christmas list to Santa, I would say, I think I'm in the mood for a little romance. I'm still very human. And with that, I will say, please keep coming back.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, let's give a warm Tulare County welcome to our featured speaker, Joyce.
Hey. This is Joyce, everybody.
Hi, my name is Joyce, and I'm an alcoholic. You know, today I'm so incredibly blessed to be able to say I'm an alcoholic and know that's the truth, because today I know what's wrong with me. Yeah, I spent a lot of years not knowing what was wrong with me, and I was actually born irritable, restless, and discontent from the beginning. You know, today I wake up and I recognize that I'm an alcoholic, and I can't have a conscious contact with God when I'm sleeping. So I wake up in a hopeless disease that's an obsession of the mind, an allergy of the body, and the malady of the spirit. And, you know, it says in our big book that there'll come a day when every alcoholic will forget with sufficient force the exact horrors of their last drunk. And because of that, I spend a few moments when I first wake up remembering what it was like 4.5 years ago when I woke up, and that despair and loneliness and guilt and shame and remorse. And, you know, and that propels me right out of bed, and I do the first 3 steps of this program. And I realize that I can't, he can, and I will let him. I spend a little bit of time kind of coming awake and spending a little bit of time in meditation. I read my daily reflections. I get ready for work, and I realize that today is the only day I have, and in order to live that day, I have to be strong enough to surrender and courageous enough to believe that God won't take me where his love won't protect me. Today is the only day that I have, and today has been fabulous because of those simple things that I do. Today I got to go to work to a job that I totally love, and I got to be a good employee. I got to work with another alcoholic and talk with him, and it was fabulous. I got to pick up my sponsor and go out to dinner with some new friends, and that was great. And tonight I get to be here with all of you. And recently in a meeting I heard one of the most incredible things I've ever heard. It said that, you know, all the people sitting out there in the chairs are miracles in progress, and the empty chairs are miracles waiting to happen. So I'm really glad that I get to be here with all of you, miracles in progress. And because they asked me to speak, and it is my night, I'm going to do my favorite thing that I get to do in recovery, and that's celebrate it. And I have my friend here that's celebrating 2 years of sobriety today, and I want to give him my tip.
Who are you?
I got a text message Monday night, and he told me, he says, "Oh, I can't believe it. I'm celebrating my 2 years on the night you talk." And I was like, what a gift. What a gift that is. Yeah, I told you how my day is today, because that's not how it was like when I got here. You know, I had spent a lot of time at night, you know, helpless and hopeless and sad and couldn't believe I drank again and miserable. And I'd call the 800 number on the AA line, and, you know, they'd answer and say, "Do you need help?" And I'd hang up, and then I'd hide thinking they were to come find me. And I did that for months and months. You know, I'd go online and I'd take the little test if you could be an alcoholic. And the only one that I didn't answer right was the one I lied about, you know, and then they'd tell me I'm an alcoholic, and I sure it was Rick because they wanted me to go. And, you know, and one morning in May, I had done that same scenario, and I got really tired of it, and I was done. I just knew that I needed to quit drinking, and I was going to go to AA. I knew nothing nothing about AA, but I was going to go because I was going to quit drinking. And I looked online and I found a meeting, and it was called Bridge Street Drunks. And I figured that that would be the best one to go to because I was a drunk. It was at noon and it was very important, so it wouldn't take much time out of my day. And I drove up over there, and you know, from the time that I left my house in the morning when I knew I was an alcoholic till the time I drove up there, and I saw these little old men sitting outside smoking cigarettes, I'm like, well, I don't know a lot about AA, but I think you have to share, and there's no way that they would know anything about me, so probably can't go in there. So my next best thinking was that I would go to the Alano Club, and I drove up there, and my dad was a police officer, and I worked in the police department, and I drove up there, and I was pretty sure we had arrested probably all the people going in there, and so I probably shouldn't go in there. You know, the stupidity of that was I was a police dispatcher. They didn't see me anyway, but that was my thinking, you know. And so I was like, well, you know, I'm not that bad, but I probably should still, like, check this thing out, you know. And so I went to a women's meeting at the Trinity Church, and I had grown up in the Christian Reformed Church, so it was a perfect place for me to go. And, you know, the amazing thing was, by the time I got there, I wasn't near as bad as all those people in that room at all, you know, and I probably didn't even really need to stick around. And they were really nice, though. They gave me a lot of little pamphlets, and a lady bought me a big book, and it was really sweet. And they gave me a chip, you know, and it was super cool. And I got home, and I didn't drink a drink at all until I got all the way home. And that was progress, not perfection. So I started thinking, you know, this might work, but I don't know. So I went back the next week, and, you know, and it worked for the day. And then I went back the next week, and the amazing thing happened because I didn't have to drink for 3 whole days. And I was on a roll. And about the 3rd day, I started thinking, well, you know, I'm feeling a little shaky, so I probably should do what they said and call somebody. Now, mind you, I didn't call the woman that had 20 years of sobriety that gave me the big book. I called the girl that said she was struggling in the meeting, because after all, I had 3 days of sobriety. I was going to help her. So I called her up, and, you know, we were talking, and she was telling me how bad it was and things were going on in her life. And I was like, well, I don't understand why you're feeling like that. I had been sober for 3 days, and it's fabulous. And she says, oh, that's your pink cloud. You're going to fall off. So I did. And I went ahead and drank. So the next week I went back, and, you know, I was like, okay, well, you know what? I got 3 days last week, so maybe the problem is I'm only going to one meeting. And they talk about going to multiple meetings. So if I go to a meeting on Tuesday, I could stay sober for 3 days. And if I go to a meeting on Friday, I could stay sober through the weekend and get back to Tuesday. So I braved it, went to the Alano Club on a Friday afternoon, and at noon, and I'm sitting there, and I already went in with a chip on my shoulder, and I was better than everybody and not near as bad as all of them. And I knew that everybody was looking at me because I had a car and they were walking, and I sat down, and, you know, I'm holding on to my purse and thinking I'm all that in a bag of chips, and I'm sitting there, and they start the meeting, and they send around the basket, and the man says, well, you know what, there's not enough money in here to make our rent, and there's a lot of people in this room, so I'm going to pass this basket around again, and you people that have a job, you probably could put in a couple more dollars and help out the person that doesn't. I was pissed. I was absolutely positively pissed, because I knew he was talking about me, and I couldn't figure out why he thought I should support everybody in that room, so I just, like, got up and huffed out. And, you know, I'm so grateful to that man, and I talk about this in my story, because it's absolutely how the program works. I went out, and had the worst drunk I'd ever had in my life, and ended up totally drunk from Friday night all the way through Saturday. I didn't drink on Sunday only because I was going out of town. I made my son my little policeman, and I wouldn't go into a store to get a soda or anything unless he went with me, so I didn't buy any alcohol. So I made it till Monday. I hadn't drank, and my best thinking at the time to not drink and drive was to buy my alcohol before I went to work, so that way I could take a little drink, because, you know, I didn't want it to explode in the freezer, and that way it would be cold when I got home, and I didn't have to buy it and drink and drive. Well, that morning I was running a little bit late for work, and I went and bought my bottle and didn't have time to put it in the freezer. So I went on to work. And from Tulare to Visalia, I drank half a pint of Jack Daniels. And I put it in the freezer at work, which wasn't abnormal. We had alcohol in the office because they'd have different clients come in at times and stuff. So I put it in the freezer in my brown paper bag, but I'm not alcoholic at all. I was drinking it out of the brown paper bag, you know. And my best thinking at the time was, you know, I kept thinking about that alcohol. So I was like, well, you know what? I might as well just go drink the rest of it so that way I could get on with my day and get my work done. So I did. Ended up in a blackout drunk at 7:30 in the morning. The only way I know that it was 7:30 in the morning is I was supposed to fax a paper, and it took me 5 days to find it, and it said that I faxed it at 7:30 and had no memory of it. Left work at 10:30, ran into my boss in the parking lot. He asked me if he could drive me home. I told him, no, I was fine, you know, and I was bawling. I'm not exactly sure what I was bawling about, but I was bawling. Went home, and I just remember bits and pieces of the road on the way home. Went into my house, passed out, woke up about 3 or 4 hours later, just clueless how that could have happened. Scared to death because I thought I had lost my job. I should have lost my job. And, you know, then I would have nothing. That was the only thing that was keeping me not alcoholic. And so I called my boss. He didn't answer. And then I had this brilliant thought. It's like, holy shit, what if I, like, hit something or hit somebody, you know? Ran out and looked at my car. My car was fine. And so I was really grateful for that. And I called. And my boss answered. And, you know, my first words were, I don't know what happened. And he's like, well, I know what happened. You showed up drunk from last night. You know, like the first time in my life I didn't correct him and go, no, I got drunk this morning. So grateful for that, you know. And so then I started my waterworks, you know, but you don't understand my life. And he said, I am tired of your bullshit. He said, you need to pull your head out of your ass. Tell me what you need right now. Come back to work because I need you. Whatever you need, I'll do whatever I can for you, but you need to tell me right now. So I told him that I would be back the next morning. And he said, okay. And the first thought that went through my head was, I can go ahead and drink the rest of tonight because I'll be fine by morning. And at that moment, I knew that I was insane. I knew that alcohol had made me insane. I did call the lady that had 20 years of sobriety. She's the one that bought me the big book. She met me that night, and, you know, she's like totally sweet. We went out to dinner. I'm trying not to vomit, and we're sitting there, and I'm telling her my sad story, and she's listening. And then she told me where to go to a meeting. She took me to a meditation meeting. Now, mind you, I'd been in a blackout drunk. I'd barely, like, choked down dinner, and she's now supposed to sit still for 10 minutes and meditate. And I'm like, man, this takes off. But I went. I went, and I sat. You know, it was really amazing sitting in that room with all the people and the meditation music. And, you know, I just had a whole different renewed sense of life at that time. And, you know, there wasn't much I remember about that meeting except the fact that this one girl was talking, and she says, I like the part of the big book that talks about how people that wouldn't normally mix come together and they stay together. And, you know, that just meant so much to me at the time. And when I look around this room tonight, there's not one person that I knew before I got here at all. And today there's many people that I call friend. There's many people that I value a lot, and there's friends that I hope to meet. And that's the most awesome thing. You know, I didn't understand it at the time that I was actually starting to associate with people in the room, that loneliness and despair. And I started, you know, she told me, she says, okay, well, we went to this meeting tonight, and do you want me to be your sponsor? And I said, okay, I'll have you be my sponsor. And she says, okay, well, you're going to go to the women's meeting the next night, and then I'm going to meet with you on Wednesday night, and we're going to start working the steps. And I'm like, well, that's an awful lot, and I'm kind of busy. And I said, what happened to Easy Does It? Can't we just kind of, like, slide into this a little bit? You know, and she's like, no, we're going to do this. And I'm like, okay. So we did exactly what she said, and she showed up, and we started working the steps. And life was going along, and it was improving, and I wasn't drinking. And, you know, she had a lot of rules. She had a lot of rules. You know, I should read this, and I should do that, and I should go to this meeting, and I should write in a book, and I should think this, and I should think that, and I should talk to these people and not to these people. And it was very confusing. very confusing. But I tried my hardest. And she was really big about lying, you know. Well, you know you're a liar. And I'm like, well, yeah, I know. They keep saying that in meetings all the time, but okay. And, you know, she would tell me all the time, but you're lying. I'm like, I'm not lying. This is the best truth I have, you know. And then she would say, it was all I knew. I was trying as hard as I could. And she kept telling me I was a liar. And then she kept telling me I stole stuff. And I'm like, I didn't. She told me I did. And so I believed her. And then I kind of found out I did. I stole a lot of stuff. But you know, it's okay. We make amends for those things, right? So anyway, we're going along. And then she told me that I needed to listen to my heart, not my head. You know, and so I started trying to really do that. And it was difficult at first. And she told me to be the quiet voice, you know, inside. And so my daughter was getting married 3 months after I got sober. And you know what? I wanted to be the best mom that I could be because I hadn't been. I hadn't been there to help her plan the wedding. I'd bought the dress, but I was drunk before and after. I just hadn't been a mom, and I got this opportunity to be a mom, and I wanted to be a mom so bad. And I was trying really hard, and my daughter called me like a week before the wedding, and I don't remember what question she asked me, but she asked me a question, and my head said one thing, and my heart said another thing, and for the first time, my heart was a lot louder, and so I said what my heart said, and then I got off the phone, and I called my sponsor and said, my daughter just called me, and I told her the answer that my heart said, and I got to get my head to catch up. And she says, well, so you lied to your daughter. I said, no, you told me to listen to my heart. I said what my heart said. You're supposed to teach me to catch my head up. And she hung up on me. But, you know, it just took a little while. And, you know, I did give that poor lady a run for her money. And she told me crazy things, though. She said, you know, you need to take care of yourself. And I'm like, look, you know what? I've been going to these meetings, and they tell me I'm selfish and self-centered, and now you tell me to take care of myself. How does that make any sense at all? And she says, you know what? Just do it. So I'm like, okay, you know, I'll just do it. So I started doing it. You know, I started doing what she asked me to do. I tried to go to as many meetings. And then she told me the best thing. You know, I hear people talk about the rooms where their sponsor tells them to take the cotton out of their ears and put it in their mouth. Mine told me that I could talk to anybody about anything I wanted to talk about, but I couldn't talk about anybody else. And you know what? I had nothing to say because all I'd done was talk about everybody else. I was like, holy cow. You know, I'd call my mom and it would be, you know, we'd have these hour, 2 hour conversations before I got sober. It's like, hi, how you doing? Okay, talk to you later. You know, I had nothing to say because all I did was pick other people apart all the time. So anyway, I started like not talking about people and started listening and I started doing what she said and taking care of myself. And you know, the most amazing thing happened. I came to find out that everybody else was taking care of themselves just fine. I just needed to quit bossing them around, telling them what to do. And you know, it was such a big relief at that point, you know. And so I was doing the steps and things were going along real well and I was trying really hard. And she told me that I needed to get a service commitment, and so she had a few in mind that I should do, and you know, and I knew that the way that this was going, that she was going to tell me that I was going to have to go back and apologize to that secretary in that meeting that I was so rude to. So I thought I'd try to get some brownie points and do it first, and so I went back to that meeting and I sat through it the whole time, and when it got over, I walked up to that gentleman and I said, you know, I really need to talk to you. And he did the thing that I really love about AA people, you know, they got that face. And they just sit and listen to you, you know. So he did that, and he's listening to my whole entire thing. And I'm telling him how rude I was and how I really should be grateful because he actually saved my life. And he's looking at me that way the whole time, and I get all done. And he puts his arm around me and gets right in my face and laughs. And he said, I don't know who you are and what you're talking about, but just keep coming back. And I was like, you know, the place that I couldn't walk into was the place that I was first told to come back. Go through, and you know, things are working out pretty well, and I'm doing what my sponsor says to the best of my ability, but I actually am just doing it like right before I met with her because I didn't want to lie. So I would like read everything she told me right before I went, and so I had something really important to say because I couldn't remember it anyway. If I read it, if a day went by, I couldn't remember what I read anyway. So, you know, I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing to the best of my ability. And it comes to be about Thanksgiving. I got sober in June of 2013, and so in and Thanksgiving of 2013, on the night before Thanksgiving, plans were changing and things were going crazy, and I was all pissed off, and I'm like, you know what, I'm pretty sure I'm not going to stay sober or not kill anybody if I don't go to a meeting before Thanksgiving. So I went to a meeting, and the only meeting that I could find that would work into the schedule that I had that day was Bridge Street Drunks. And I thought, well, I've already been back to the Alano Cliff, so I'll go back to Bridge Street Drunks. So I did. I walked in, sat down, and you know, nobody asked why I was there or should I be there. They just welcomed me. And actually, for the first time, I felt like I was home. And you know, I thought, wow, this is a pretty awesome feeling. And so I went back the next Friday, and I was so excited because they told me, they're like, how long have you been sober? I'm like, I've been sober like 6 months. And they're like, oh, good, we need a secretary on Saturday morning, or on Friday morning. And I'm like, oh, wow, she wanted me to get a service commitment that wasn't on her list, but it's one, you know. And I told her, and she wasn't really impressed by that, but it's okay because I had one. And, you know, I thought, wow, you know, how cool this is, because they're starting to recognize me, and they're seeing that I'm doing a good job, and I'm like being important in AA, you know. And I showed up there the first Friday morning, and I came to find out that the majority of them wanted to go to the men's meeting, so they couldn't get anybody to do the secretary on Friday morning. And I was like, well then, you know, but it was okay, because, you know, one gentleman, he did stay, and he's a diehard Bridge Street Drunk 7 a.m. meeting person, and another person in this room too is, and those gentlemen were there, and they would share their experience, strength, and hope. And I would go to a meeting only on Friday morning. By that point, I was only going to meetings on Friday morning because, quite frankly, that sponsor was really pissing me off. She, like, had too many rules, and she was way too bossy, and she was putting too much constraint on my time because she didn't understand that, you know, it wasn't going to take me that long to get sober. So I just stopped calling her, and it was working out really well for me because I just didn't talk to her, and I didn't go anywhere she went, and I went to my Friday morning meeting. And I was really, really busy with work. And at that point, what I was doing was I was working 85 hours a week and going to that one meeting. And I did stay sober, and I was absolutely, positively miserable. And after about 6 months of doing that, I came to realize that the magic for me was happening in that room, because I was seeing people come in on that Friday morning. There wasn't a lot of us. And there were the two gentlemen that were always showing up all the time, but the rest of the people that were coming in, they were coming in from the mission. And everything that they owned, they had in a bag. And they would come in and sit down and get a cup of coffee, and they would listen to the meeting, and they would share. And they had something I had never had. They had hope. Hope for a different way of life. Hope if they worked this program and didn't drink, hope that their life would turn around. And I realized that I had never had any hope at all. So I called that sponsor, and I told her that, I said, you know, I really realize I need to get back in this program, and I need to start doing exactly what you say when you say it. And I told her, I said, you know, but I am working 85 hours a week right now, and, you know, it's going to end in a month, so I'll go to as many meetings as I possibly can, and as soon as that's over, I'll do more. She says, okay. So we met, and we talked, and we were picking up where we left off, and like within a week, she's like calling me, well, you're not at this meeting, you're not at... I said, I am working 85 hours a week. I am like doing everything I can. I told you I got 3 more weeks, and I'm going to be at every meeting you want me to be at. She's like, well, that's not good enough, blah, blah, blah. And I said, you know what, I don't think this is going to work. I just don't think this is going to work at all. I said, you know, I appreciate everything you've done for me. I wouldn't be sober this long, because it's about a year and a half at that point, if it wasn't for you in this program, but I can't do this. It's not going to work. And I was scared to death. I was absolutely positively scared to death, because I didn't know what I was going to do. I didn't have a sponsor, and you're supposed to have a sponsor. Every time you go to a meeting, they tell you to sponsor, and now I don't have a sponsor. What am I going to do now? So I went to a women's meeting thinking, well, that's a good place to meet other women. I had a women's meeting, and I went to that meeting, and after that meeting, a lady, and this lady, I'm just going to preface this a little bit, I absolutely positively hated her when I got here. Every time I saw her, I hated her. Every time she talked, I hated her. And if I didn't hate her then, I'd think of a reason I hated her when I got home. And I was going to stay far, far away from her, no matter what. She is the one that talked to me after the meeting, and we talked for about 2 hours after the meeting. And, you know, she said the most wonderful thing to me. She says, you you know, I think this program is working for you because you're starting to make sense. Like, oh my gosh, she can understand me. She probably should be my sponsor. So I invited her over to my house, and, you know, we talked a little bit, and I finally got around to it. And she asked me, she says, well, what do you want out of sobriety? And I'm thinking, God, how stupid is this lady? She's got like 40 years of sobriety, and she's asking me what I want. I want to be sober. What do you think I want? And she's like, no, what do you want? She says, so I don't really know what I want. I just want something different. And she says, well, she says, I could help you work on your problems, and we could work on the steps, and I don't really like the word sponsor, so I could be your mentor. And I said, oh, okay, I like that. And then she says, I'm going to be very clear. You have to take responsibility for your own sobriety, because I'm going to stay sober no matter what, and if you die, you die. And she got up and left. And I went, well, that went a little different than the last sponsor. That other sponsor told me when to even wipe my ass. She told me I had to be responsible, scare me to death. So, you know, I wasn't really sure how I felt about that. And so she didn't tell me to call her or anything, and I wasn't going to anyway. And I spent like the next week just sleepless, just absolutely positively sleepless. And that hadn't happened to me since I got sober, and I couldn't understand it. And, you know, after about 3 or 4 nights like that, I woke up about 2 o'clock in the morning because I would sleep just a little bit here and there. And it dawned on me, maybe I should read the big book. And I got the big book out, and I started reading the big book, and it was just magical to me. I was reading the big book because I wanted to read the big book, and I was seeing my story on every page of the big book, and I was seeing that there was a way out, and I didn't have to live like this. And when I got done with that first 164 pages, I called a sponsor, and she says, well, I was kind of wondering if you're going to call me, because I was wondering if I went overboard with the if you die, you die thing. And I said, you told me if I die, I die. And she says, well, yeah. I said, oh, man, I was scared shitless at responsible. I didn't hear that part. So I started working with this lady. And, you know, to be honest with you, I still was doing just my Friday morning commitment. And I would go to the women's meeting, and that was about it. And we went through several months of that. And things were changing. They were changing dramatically. And I came upon an issue with my son, and it was pretty overwhelming. And, you know, at one point I stopped, and, you know, all I could think was, if I don't go to a meeting, I'm going to end up getting drunk. I just don't know how to deal with this. And so I went to a meeting, and I felt a lot better, and I was continuing to work with her. And we came up to this big instance with my son, and I had to, like, set some boundaries and make some rules, you know. And I was afraid to do that because he might leave. And if he left, then I would be alone. And I had come to realize that I had a vision of myself drinking myself to death in a hotel room. And I didn't really want to be alone, so I didn't really want to run him off. But I knew I needed to do it for myself. And so I ended up calling my sponsor, and she wasn't available at the moment. And so I called another lady in the program, and she asked me if I wanted to come over. And I went over to her house, and in the meantime, my sponsor called me, and I told her where I was going. She said, that was great. And I spent 4 hours with this lady crying and going through my stuff and all that. And I woke up the next morning, and I still didn't feel really good about it. So I called my sponsor, met with her, had another 4 hour, you know, cry and get my feelings out, and the whole nine yards. And I was like so grateful that I wasn't a drama queen, because I'd hate to see how I acted then. And I told her, I said, you know, I just can't thank you enough for this. And, you know, she says, well, you know what, it takes a lot of tomatoes to make tomato paste. She says, but, she says, you're going to have to get connected or you're going to wear me out. And, you know, I've never been so scared in my life. I was so afraid that I would wear her out, and I wanted what she had. So I, like, threw myself into meetings like you wouldn't believe. And it wasn't because I didn't want to associate and be around other alcoholics. I'm just, like, totally socially awkward. I mean, I just, like, totally freak out in big groups and stuff. But I didn't want to wear her out, so I started going to meetings. And every meeting that I went to, they had a service commitment, so I just took a service commitment too, because then I knew I'd go to the meetings. And then all of a sudden I was going to this meeting, that meeting, and a service commitment, and I was learning things. And I went back to my sponsor's house to meet with her, because I was meeting with her every other week. And she looked at me one day and she says, how many meetings are you going to now? And I said, oh, you know what, it's kind of a slow week, I only made it to 8. And she said, you did? And I said, yeah. And she says, how many service commitments do you have? I said, oh, only four. It's all I could do right now. And she looks at me and she said, and I'm serious. You know, I'm serious as a heart attack. And she says, well, has anything changed in your life? And I said, what do you mean? And she says, well, aren't you still working four jobs? And I said, oh, yeah. And she says, don't you still, like, take care of this and that? And I said, yeah. And she says, well, how do you have so much time to go to meetings? And I looked at her and I'm like, don't you understand? I am an alcoholic. I need to go to meetings because I want to stay sober. And she's like, oh, you know. And I mean, I didn't realize how ridiculous I was sounding, you know. She'd been telling me this forever, and I finally got it, you know. But the most incredible thing happened when I started going to meetings, because I started hearing how other people worked this program and things that they were doing. And every time I had a problem, I seemed to find the answer in the meetings. And, you know, and I always had my sponsor to run things by. And, you know, she always kind of helped me put things in perspective. And, you know, I was dealing with this issue with my son I spoke about a few minutes ago. And I went to a meeting one morning. And, you know, I was still, like, wrestling it around in my mind. And nobody really knew what was going on but my sponsor. And I was sitting in the meeting. And the man that had been there, like, the whole time, I call him my angel because I totally love this man. He was telling this story about a man that we raised his son, and the son always got in trouble, and, you know, that he was always bailing him out. And finally he said, you know what, you're God's son, and God, you need to take him back. And the next time they came to have him bail him out of trouble, he says, you know what, that's God's son, it's not my son. And, you know, that just resonated with me. You know, I've done what I can for my son to the best of my ability, and he's an adult. What he does is none of my business. I'm just here to love him, and he needs to do what he needs to do, and I'm not responsible. And, you know, and I left that meeting, and I was, like, happy, and I was sad, and I had a bellyache, and I wanted to cry, and I wanted to laugh, and everything made sense, and the world was brighter. And I was like, oh, man, I think this is one of those spiritual awakening things, you know. And I wanted to talk about it, and then I'm like, if I talk about this, everybody I know is going to think I'm crazy. And so I took my lunch break, and I called my sponsor, and we talked this through, and she's like, yeah, it's a spiritual awakening, and things start making sense, and everything makes it's a little easier. And, you know, and I says, yeah, you know what, this is pretty fabulous, but I don't really want to do it again ever, because I said that's just way too many emotions that happened all at once, and I don't really want to ever do it again. She says, well, you know what, why don't you think about it like an orgasm? She says, it'll just be a spiritual orgasm. And I'm like, oh, I would do that again, you know. She always made it fun. She always made it entertaining, you know. So then, you know, we're about that time. Now I'm getting to about 2 years sober, and it's like, I know I belong in these meetings. I know I'm an alcoholic, but I feel kind of bad being here because I don't have a story like everybody has a story. You know, I grew up in a really good home. My mom worked for the church as a secretary. My dad was a cop. We had everything we needed. We had lots. I mean, there was, like, no reason I should be an alcoholic. There wasn't even alcohol around our house very much. You know, I'd never been to jail. I hadn't lost my job. I hadn't lost my kids. You know, I'm like, I don't have any story. And, you know, I was telling my sponsor, and she says, well, be careful of what you ask for, because you usually will get it. Well, she was right, because I started going to meetings, and, like, the craziest stuff started happening. You know, people would call on me, and they'd be talking about how they wanted to kill themselves, and one night somebody called on me, and I'm like, yeah, you know, I guess I thought about killing myself too, but I was pretty afraid I'd mess that up. You know, I messed up a one-night stand, and if you can mess up a one-night stand, you're probably not going to do killing yourself for a while. And I'm like, yeah, I probably didn't need to tell 25 people that one, you know? And it just kind of continued like that. And then the most amazing thing happened on the day that I had my second birthday. I was sick. I was sicker than a dog with the stomach flu. And as I had my head in that toilet, I was like, you know what? I must have had my head in the toilet a lot, because my toilets were a lot cleaner when I was drinking than they are now. I was like, holy. holy cow. And then I was like, you know what? I can't believe this is what the stomach flu feels like, because, man, I had the stomach flu about 15 times last year and called into work, and I never felt this bad. I was like, this is pretty crazy stuff. And, you know, and then it just kind of continued like that. And, you know, they always talked about being selfish and self-centered. And, you know, I didn't really think I was that bad. And then I was talking to this guy on the phone one night, and I was in the program, and I was like, oh my God, you know what? I found out I was a blackout drinker. And he's like, how'd you find that out? And I said, well, I said, back when I was drinking, me and my girlfriends decided that we had to have a little higher standard for the men that we were finding, and we decided that they needed to have their own hair, their own teeth, and a job. And we were 30, and we decided that after, you know, like checking that out for a bit, that maybe it would be okay if they had their own teeth and a job, because there was some pretty good looking bald men, so we didn't want to let them. So I'm out in the bar, and we're dancing, having a great old time. And I was dancing with this guy, and he wasn't meeting the criteria, but he was kind of cute. So I was dancing the last dance, and he was going to dip me, and I was pretty sure he was too drunk to dip me. And so I was trying to catch myself, because I wasn't near as drunk as him, and he was really drunk, and I was really drunk, and I ended up falling, and I broke my knee on the dance floor. I was sitting on the dance floor, and everybody thought I was just trying to cause a scene, but I really couldn't get up. And so anyway, I didn't know. I was with a nurse at the time, and she told me I just pulled the meniscus and the muscles, so I walked around on it for a month, drinking beer at night so it didn't hurt so bad, and having this knee that's this big. Going to the hospital, have surgery to get the meniscus fixed, because they didn't do an x-ray, and bone fragments came out. That's how they found out it was broken. And I'm in the recovery room, you know, like all nasty, had puked a few times, and there he was, the love of my life. He was a recovery room nurse. He had his own teeth. He had his own hair. And he had a job. And he thought I was cute. And I'd already puked all over myself. So it's a winner. So we started that love fest for a while and went on for about 4 or 5 weeks. And I knew I had totally scored. And, you know, I could be on my crutches and I could still go out to the bars because I had my nurse with me. And it was all good. And imagine my surprise one morning when I went to bring him coffee and I knocked on the bathroom door and he was brushing his teeth, and they were not in his mouth. At the time, I wasn't drunk, because it was morning. I had slept it off, and he told me, well, I had really bad teeth. And I said, well, that might have been something you told me. You knew what rolls. He says, well, but I really liked you. I'm like, oh, it's okay, sweetheart. And, you know, we went out like a week later, and we went drinking. And, you know, the next morning, I woke up, I was by myself, and I couldn't figure out why I was by myself. So I called him, and he was mad. And I was like, all I remembered was being mad at him. And so I'm like, well, why should I apologize to you? What did I do? I know you did. Well, I don't know what I thought he did, but he hung up on me and never saw him ever again. And I had been thinking about him a lot, and I came to find out this program, when I'm thinking about something like a lot, then, you know, it's probably teaching me something and I need to pay attention. And I was like, you know what? I might have been a blackout drinker, and God only knows what I said that last night, you know? And so I'm telling this guy that's on the phone, and in the meantime, while I'm talking to him, and he's laughing his ass off, and I'm like, well, then, you know, the more people laugh, and the more you carry on. So we're like having a great old time. And this girl calls in, and I see that she was calling, and she was new in the program, and she's having a hard time. And I let it go to voicemail because I finished up my conversation, and then I got on the phone with her, and or I listened to the message, and she says, you know, I'm having a really hard time, and I wanted to talk to somebody that, you know, has some common sense. And I'm thinking, and you called me? Okay. So I called her back, because that's what we do in this program, and she didn't answer. And then I was getting kind of worried. It's like, oh my God, you know what? I probably should have got off the phone and called her. I'm just laughing about blackouts, and I should have helped this girl. And, you know, and I was getting really worried about her because she's having a hard time not drinking. And she called me back about 10 o'clock, and she didn't want to drink, and she was going through a problem with her boyfriend, and he was cheating on her and this and that. And, you know, all I could think at that moment is, whatever I have to do to make her not want to drink, that's all that matters. And everything she said, I had something I had done worse. And we went on like this for about 30 minutes, you know, and she's like, but you don't understand. I, like, looked through his phone. I'm like, you don't understand. I changed his girlfriend girlfriend's name to homewrecker. So when she called, it, you know, and that was the least of what I did. But, you know, and so we did this for like 30 minutes. And, you know, she says, man, if somebody as fucked up as you can stay sober, I know I can. I'm all proud of myself, you know. And then I'm like, holy shit, I need to call my sponsor. I am a mess. But, you know, it's just been an incredible, incredible journey. You know, the more that I go to meetings and the more I hear other people, the more I come to realize my story and exactly how sick and delusional I was when I got here. You know, we talk about our stories and there are some funny things and we can make light of it, but I would never in a million years want to go back to those days. You know, the person I mentioned that's sitting in this room, he told me one day, he says, you know, I think you should go to the meeting in Exeter. And I did that, and I met some really awesome people. And then he told me I should go to the 10th step group. And I went to the 10th step group, and I listened to him, and he had this whiteboard, and he was writing out, and he was talking about how when you do the 10th step and take your inventory, you really have to use all the steps. And he kind of built this circle. And it was like so incredibly profound to me, because for the first time in my life, I came to realize that if you're really working this program, you're using all the steps all the time, all day long. And I went, holy crap. You know, I was just trying to get through those steps and check them off because I thought I was going to graduate. I didn't know this was a lifelong thing. And, you know, and then the other thought was, well, all I hear in meetings is I'm reworking my steps. And I'm thinking, well, hell, if I got to rework them, why do I got to do them so well the first time, you know? And he just made that make so much sense. And, you know, it just made such a turn in my recovery for me. And I started to realize that, you know, I have to apply these principles all the time because just not drinking wasn't enough. I tried that. It didn't work out real well for me. I wanted to learn to live. And, you know, it was totally amazing how this has worked for me. And, you know, as I continue to grow in the program, I continue to learn things, and I kind of thought that some of that you know, blurting out stuff in meetings about my life, you know, and I tried to remind myself that the fifth step says we only have to tell God, ourselves, and one other person. I didn't have to tell a whole meeting, you know, and I thought, well, you know, once I get my story out and get it a little more secure, I probably won't have to do that. And, you know, that's not true. It's not true at all, because there's always still things to learn. And there's a person in the program, he's actually in this room tonight too, and, you know, I didn't like this person either. I didn't like him at all, and it was really cool because we didn't cross paths very often. And, you know, then we started crossing paths, and I came to find out that, you know, when I didn't like people, it's because I wasn't healthy enough to be around them, and I wasn't healthy enough to hear the message they had to share. And, you know, I started recognizing that. So when the people would start coming around more, I knew it was God telling me that it was time. It was time for me to learn the lessons from them. And, you know, this guy ended up being a sponsor of somebody I know, and I see this person, like, grow. And it's like totally remarkably beautiful. And this person was going to be sharing at a meeting, so it's like I wanted to go to that meeting. And so I went to that meeting and I heard his story. And, you know, for the first time in his story, I saw myself and heard myself. And he called on me at the meeting. And, you know, I don't know what it is about my mouth. Sometimes it doesn't have a filter, because I looked at him and I said, you know, when I'm going to go to a meeting and hear somebody speak and I want to hear them speak, I try to think what it is about them that I really like. And I said, you know, I hated you. I hated you from the minute I met you. And then I said, but, you know, tonight as I heard you talk, I realized I didn't hate you. I hated me. I hated what alcohol had done to me. I hated the way that I treated people, destroyed them, talked about them, demeaned them to try to make myself better. And even though we come from a whole different background, we look completely different, we're the same. And I am so grateful for that person that said that message that day, that I was able to see that. That man also gave me a tape of Bill talking at a meeting on the night that Bob died. And as I listened to that tape just a few weeks ago, you know, I realized for the first time that I've been working this program, enjoying this beautiful life, waiting for the other shoe to drop and take it away. because that's what's always happened in my life. Nothing good has ever happened in my life, and this is the best I've ever had. And I didn't want it to go away. And as I listened to that tape for the first time, I realized that I always had an underlying question of how true is this program and how real is it? How much does it have been convoluted by other people's ideas? And as I listened to Bill tell that story in that tape, was everything in the big book exactly like it is. And every person that I know that's working the steps are doing them exactly how they were all those years ago when they came up with this program. And I was set free on such a new, different level because I realized that the shoe isn't going to drop and drop on me. I can continue to move forward. And that was an awesome experience, and I'm so grateful for that person. Absolutely, positively. This program's amazing. If you're new here, keep coming back. I can tell you I came here with an agenda. I got nothing at all that I ever wanted. Nothing. But today I have everything I need. And everything I need is bigger than anything I could have ever wanted. Today, I'm a mother. I'm a grandmother. I can be a friend. The greatest gift anybody ever says to me is, "How are you, my friend?" That is awesome, to be a friend. You know, I understand that we're here to be a channel of love and service. And I can do that today. And as long as I stay in the principles of this program and use them, my sponsor uses this, and I'm going to end with this. The steps are really easy. The steps protect me from me. They're the fence around my playground. If I stay in that playground, I'm fine. When I put my foot out or step out the other way, I'm going to suffer the consequences. And that reminds me, and the super thing that's cool about that playground, there's no top. You can go as high as you want to go with that spiritual connection, and you can have whatever life you're supposed to have if you just believe. She also told me that the traditions protect AA from me, and that's really a good thing too, and so I have to practice those, because sometimes I get a little bit too much personality going on and not enough principles, but then I know it's time to excuse myself. So thank you for letting me share. I'm glad you're all on this journey with me.